This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents 10th of December, written and read by George Saunders. Victory Lap. 3 days shy of her 15th birthday, Allison Pope paused at the top of the stairs. Say the staircase was marble. Say she descended and all heads turned. Where was Special One? Approaching now, bowing slightly, he exclaimed, "How can so much grace be contained in one small package?" Oops. Had he said small package? And just stood there? Broad prince-like face, totally bland of expression? Poor thing, sorry, no way. Down he went. He was definitely not Special One. What about this guy, behind Mr. Small Package, standing near the home entertainment center, with a thick neck of farmer integrity yet tender, ample lips, who, placing one hand on the small of her back, whispered, "Dreadfully sorry you had to endure that bit about the small package just now. Let us go stand on the moon, or in the moon, in the moonlight." Had he said, "Let us go stand on the moon"? If so, she would have to be like, eyebrows up. And if no wry acknowledgement was forthcoming, be like, I am not exactly dressed for standing on the moon, which as I understand it is super cold. Come on, guy, she couldn't keep treading gracefully on this marble stairwell in her mind forever. That dear old white hair in the tiara was getting all like, "Why are those supposed princes making that darling girl march in place ad nausea?" Plus, she had a recital tonight and had to go fetch her tights from the dryer. Egads, one found oneself still standing at the top of the stairs. Do the thing where, facing upstairs, hand on railing, you hop down the stairs one at a time, which was getting a lot harder lately, due to someone's feet were getting longer every day, seemed like. Pas-de-chat, pas-de-chat, changement, changement. Hop over thin metal thingy separating hallway tile from living room rug. Curtsy to self in entryway mirror. "Come on, Mom, get here. We do not wish to be castrated by Ms. Callow again in the wings." Although actually, she loved Ms. C. So strict. Also loved the other girls in class. And the girls from school. Loved them. Everyone was so nice. Plus the boys at her school. Plus the teachers at her school. All of them were doing their best. Actually, she loved her whole town. That adorable grocer spraying his lettuce. Pastor Carol with her large, comfortable butt. The chubby postman gesticulating with his padded envelopes. It had once been a mill town. Wasn't that crazy? What did that even mean? Also, she loved her house. Across the creek was the Russian church. So ethnic. That onion dome had loomed in her window since her poo footy days. Also, loved Gladsong Drive. Every house on Gladsong was a Corona Del Mar. That was amazing. If you had a friend on Gladsong, you already knew where everything was in his or her home. J'étais rond de jambe, pas de bourré. On a happy whim, do front roll, hop to your feet, kiss the picture of Mom and Dad taken at Penny's back in the Stone Ages when you were that little cutie right there, kiss, with a hair bow bigger than all outdoors. Sometimes, feeling happy like this, she imagined a baby deer trembling in the woods. "Where's your mama, little guy?"
"I don't know,"
the deer said in the voice of Heather's little sister, Becca. "Are you afraid?" she asked it. "Are you hungry? Do you want me to hold you?"
"Okay,"
the baby deer said. Here came the hunter now, dragging the deer's mother by the antlers. Her guts were completely splayed. Geez, that was nice. She covered the baby's eyes and was like, "Don't you have anything better to do, dank hunter, than kill this baby's mom? You seem like a nice enough guy."
"Is my mom killed?"
the baby said in Becca's voice. "No, no," she said. "This gentleman was just leaving." The hunter, captivated by her beauty, doffed his cap and, going down on one knee, said, "If I could will life back into this fawn, I would do so, in hopes you might defer one tender kiss upon our elderly forehead." "Go," she said, "only, for your task of penance, do not eat her. Lay her out in a field of clover with roses strewn about her, and bestow a choir to softly sing of her foul end."
"Lay who out?"
the baby deer said. "No one," she said. "Never mind. Stop asking so many questions." Pas-de-chat, pas-de-chat, changement, changement. She felt hopeful that Special One would hail from far away. The local boys possessed a certain je ne sais quoi, which, tell the truth, she was not très crazy about, such as actually name their own nuts. She had overheard that. and aspired to work for County Power because the work shirts were awesome and you got them free. So, ixnay on the local boys. A special ixnay on Matt Dre, owner of the largest mouth in the land. Kissing him last night at the pep rally had been like kissing an underpass. Scary. Kissing Matt was like suddenly this cow in a sweater is bearing down on you, who will not take no for an answer, and his huge cow head is being flooded by chemicals that are drowning out what little powers of reason Matt actually did have. What she liked was being in charge of her. Her body, her mind, her thoughts, her career, her future. That was what she liked. So be it. We might have a slight snack. Un petit repas. Was she special? Did she consider herself special? Oh gosh, she didn't know. In the history of the world, many had been more special than her. Helen Keller had been awesome. Mother Teresa was amazing. Mrs. Roosevelt was quite chipper, in spite of her husband, who was handicapped, which, in addition, she had been gay with those big old teeth. Long before such time as being gay and First Lady was even conceptual, she, Allison, could not hope to compete in the category of those ladies. Not yet, anyway. There was so much she didn't know, like how to change the oil, or even check the oil, how to open the hood, how to bake brownies. That was embarrassing, actually, being a girl and all. And what was a mortgage? Did it come with the house? When you breastfed, did you have to, like, push the milk out? Egads, who is this wan figure visible through the living room window, trotting up Gladsong Drive? Kyle Boot, palest kid in all the land? Still dressed in his weird cross-country toggles? Poor thing, he looked like a skeleton with a mullet. Were those cross-country shorts from the, like, Charlie's Angels days or qua? How could he run so well when he seemed to have literally no muscles? Every day he ran home like this, shirtless with his backpack on, then hit the remote from down by the fungs and scooted into his garage without breaking stride. He almost had to admire the poor goof. They'd grown up together, been little beaners in that mutual sandbox down by the creek. Hadn't they bathed together when we or some such crud? She hoped that never got out. Because in terms of friends, Kyle was basically down to Fetty Slavko, who walked leaning way backward and was always retrieving things from between his teeth, announcing the name of the retrieved thing in Greek, then re-eating it. Kyle's mom and dad didn't let him do squat. He had to call home if the movie in world culture might show bare boobs. Each of the items in his lunchbox was clearly labeled. Pas de bourrée and curtsy. Poor quantity of cheese doodles in the compartmentalized old-school Tupperware dealy. Thanks, Mom. Thanks, Dad. Your kitchen rocks. Shake Tupperware dealy back and forth like panning for gold, then offer to some imaginary poor gathered around. Please enjoy. Is there anything else I can do for you folks?
You've already done enough, Allison, by even deigning to speak to us.
That is so not true. Don't you understand all people deserve respect? Each of us is a rainbow.
Really? Look at this big open sore on my poor shriveled flank.
Allow me to fetch you some Vaseline.
That would be much appreciated. This thing kills.
But as far as that rainbow idea, she believed that. People were amazing. Mom was awesome. Dad was awesome. Her teachers worked so hard and had kids of their own, and some were even getting divorced, such as Mrs. D's, but still always took time for their students. What she found especially inspiring about Mrs. D's was that even though Mr. D's was cheating on Mrs. D's with the lady who ran the bowling alley, Mrs. D's was still teaching the best course ever in ethics, posing such questions as, can goodness win? Or do good people always get shafted, evil being more reckless? That last bit seemed to be Mrs. D's taking a shot at the bowling alley gal. But seriously, is life fun or scary? Are people good or bad? On the one hand, that clip of those gauntish, pale bodies being steamrolled while fat German ladies looked on chomping gum. On the other hand, sometimes rural folks, even if their particular farms were on hills, stayed up late filling sandbags. In their straw poll, she had voted for people being good and life being fun, with Mrs. D's giving her a pitying glance as she stated her views. To do good, you just have to decide to do good. You have to be brave. You have to stand up for what's right. At that last, Mrs. Dees had made this kind of groan, which is fine. Mrs. Dees had a lot of pain in her life, yet interestingly, still obviously found something fun about life and good about people. Because otherwise, why sometimes stay up so late grading, you come in next day all exhausted, blouse on backward, having messed it up in the early morning dark, you dear discombobulated thing? Here came a knock on the door. Back door. Interesting. Who could it be? Father Dimitri from across the way? UPS? FedEx? With un petit chèque pour papa? J'étais rond de jam. Pas de bourré. Open door and... Here was a man she did not know. Quite huge fellow in one of those meter reader vests. Something told her to step back in, slam the door. But that seemed rude. Instead, she froze, smiled, did eyebrow raise to indicate, "May I help you?" Next door, Kyle Boot dashed through the garage into the living area where the big clock-like wooden indicator was set at all out. Other choices included Mom and Dad out, Mom out, Dad out, Kyle out, Mom and Kyle out, Dad and Kyle out, and all in. Why did they even need all in? Wouldn't they know it when they were all in? Would he like to ask Dad that? Who, in his excellent, totally silent downstairs woodshop, had designed and built the family status indicator? Ha. Ha ha. On the kitchen island was a work notice. Scout. New geode on deck. Place in yard per included drawing. No goofing. Rake areas first, put down plastic as I've shown you. Then lay in white rock. This geode expensive. Please take seriously. No reason this should not be done by time I get home. This equals 5 work points. Guard, Dad, do you honestly feel it fair that I should have to slave in the yard until dark after a rigorous cross-country practice that included 16 440s, 8 880s, a mile for time, a gajillion drake sprints, and a 5-mile Indian relay?
I'll shoes off, mister.
Yoink's too late. He was already at the TV and had left an incriminating trail of microclods, waverboating. Could the microclods be hand-plucked? Although problem, if he went back to hand-pluck the microclods, he'd leave an incriminating new trail of microclods. He took off his shoes and stood mentally rehearsing a little show he liked to call What If Right Now? What if they came home right now? It's a funny story, Dad. I came in thoughtlessly, then realized what I'd done. I guess when I think about it, what I'm happy about is how quickly I self-corrected. The reason I came in so thoughtlessly was I wanted to get right to work, Dad, per your note. He raced in his socks to the garage, threw his shoes into the garage, ran for the vacuum, vacuumed up the microclods, then realized, holy golly, he had thrown his shoes into the garage rather than placing them on the shoe sheet as required, toes facing away from the door for ease of donage later. He stepped into the garage, placed his shoes on the shoe sheet, stepped back inside.
"Aw, Scout," Dad said in his head. "Has anyone ever told you that even the most neatly maintained garage is going to have some oil on its floor, which is now on your socks, being tracked all over the Tan Berber?"
Oh, gar, his ass was grass. "But no, celebrate good times. Come on, no oil stain on rug." He tore off his socks. It was absolutely verboten for him to be in the main living area barefoot. Mom and Dad, coming home to find him tarzaning around like some sort of white trasher, would not be the least fucking bit.
"All swearing in your head?" Dad said in his head. "Step up, Scott, be a man. If you want to swear, swear aloud."
I don't want to swear aloud.
"Then don't swear in your head."
Mom and Dad would be heartsick if they could hear the swearing he sometimes did in his head, such as crap, cunt, shit, turd, dick in the ear, butt, creamery. Why couldn't he stop doing that? They thought so highly of him, sending weekly braggy emails to both sets of grandparents, such as, "Kyle's been super busy keeping up his grades while running varsity cross country, though still a sophomore, while setting aside a little time each day to manufacture such humdingers as cuntswoggle, rear fuck." What was wrong with him? Why couldn't he be grateful for all that Mom and Dad did for him instead of, "Cornhole the ear, cunt! Flake fuck the pale vestige with the prodding dick meat!" You could always clear the mind with a hard pinch on your own minimal love handle. Ouch! Hey, today was Tuesday, a major treat day. The 5 new work points for placing the geode, plus his existing 2 work points, totaled 7 work points, which added to his 8 accrued usual chore points made 15 total treat points, which could garner him a major treat. For example, 2 handfuls of yogurt-covered raisins, plus 20 free choice TV minutes.
although the particular show would have to be negotiated with Dad at time of cash-in. One thing you will not be watching, Scout, is America's Most Outspoken Dirt Bikers. Whatever. Whatever, Dad. Really, Scout? Whatever? Will it be whatever when I take away all your treat points and force you to quit cross-country, as I have several times threatened to do if a little more cheerful obedience wasn't forthcoming? No. I don't want to quit, Dad. Please, I'm good at it. You'll see. First meet. Even Matt Dre said, who is Matt Dre? Some ape on the football team? Yes. Is his word law? No. What did he say? Little shit can run. Nice talk, Scout. Ape talk. Anyway, you may not make it to the first meet. Your ego seems to be overflowing its banks. And why? Because you can jog. Anyone can jog. Beasts of the field can jog. I'm not quitting, anal cock, shitbird, rectum fritz. Please, I'm begging you. It's the only thing I'm decent at. Mom, if he makes me quit, I swear to God I'll... Drama doesn't suit you, beloved only.
Well, if you want the privilege of competing in a team sport, Scout, show us that you can live within our perfectly reasonable system of directives designed to benefit you.
Hello. A van had just pulled up in the St. Mikhail's parking lot. Kyle walked in a controlled, gentlemanly manner to the kitchen counter. On the counter was Kyle's traffic log, which served the dual purpose of, one, buttressing Dad's argument that Father Dimitri should build a soundproof retaining wall, and two, constituting a data set for a possible science fair project for him, Kyle, entitled, by Dad, Correlation of Church Parking Lot Volume versus Day of Week, with ancillary investigation of Sunday volume throughout year. Smiling agreeably, as if he enjoyed filling out the log, Kyle very legibly filled out the log. Vehicle, van. Color, gray. Make, Chevy. Year, unknown. A guy got out of the van, one of the usual Ruskies. Rusky was an allowed slang. Also, dang it. Also, holy golly. Also, crapper. The Ruski was wearing a jean jacket over a hoodie, which, in Kyle's experience, was not unusual church wear for the Ruskies, who sometimes came directly over from Jiffy Lube, still wearing coveralls. Under vehicle driver, he wrote, probable parishioner. That sucked. Stank, rather. The guy being a stranger, he, Kyle, now had to stay inside until the stranger left the neighborhood, which totally futzed up his geode placing. He'd be out there until midnight. What a detriment. The guy put on a day-glow vest. Ah, dude was a meter reader. The meter reader looked left, then right, leaped across the creek, entered the Pope backyard, passed between the soccer ball rebounder and the in-ground pool, then knocked on the Pope door. Good leap there, Boris. The door swung open. Allison. Kyle's heart was singing. He'd always thought that was just a phrase. Allison was like a national treasure. In the dictionary, under beauty, there should be a picture of her in that jean skirt. Although, lately, she didn't seem to like him all that much. Now she stepped across her deck so the meter reader could show her something. Something electrical wrong on the roof? The guy seemed eager to show her. Actually, he had her by the wrist and was, like, tugging. That was weird, wasn't it? Well, something had never been weird around here before, so probably it was fine. Probably the guy was just a really new meter reader. Somehow Kyle felt like stepping out onto the deck. He stepped out. The guy froze. Allison's eyes were scared horse eyes. The guy cleared his throat, turned slightly to let Kyle see something. A knife. The meter reader had a knife. Here's what you're doing, the guy said. Standing right there until we leave. Move a muscle, I knife her in the heart. Swear to God. Got it? Kyle's mouth was so spitless, all he could do was make his mouth do the shape it normally did when saying yes. Now they were crossing the yard. Allison threw herself to the ground. The guy hauled her up. She threw herself down. He hauled her up. It was odd, seeing Allison tossed like a rag doll in the sanctuary of the perfect yard her dad had made for her. She threw herself down. The guy hissed something and she rose, suddenly docile. In his chest, Kyle felt the many directives, major and minor, he was right now violating. He was on the deck shoeless, on the deck shirtless, was outside when a stranger was near, had engaged with that stranger. Last week, Sean Ball had brought a wig to school to more effectively mimic the way Bev Murren chewed her hair when nervous. Kyle had briefly considered intervening. At evening meeting, Mom has said that she considered Kyle's decision not to intervene judicious. Dad has said, "That was none of your business. You could have been badly hurt." Mom had said, "Think of all the resources we've invested in you, beloved only." Dad had said, "I know we sometimes strike you as strict, but you are literally all we have." They were at the soccer ball rebounder now, Allison's arm up behind her back. She was making a low, repetitive sound of denial, like she was trying to invent a noise that would adequately communicate her feelings about what she just this instant realized was going to happen to her. He was just a kid. There was nothing he could do. In his chest, he felt the lush release of pressure that always resulted when he submitted to a directive. There at his feet was the geode. He should just look at that until they left. It was a great one, maybe the greatest one ever. The crystals at the cutaway glistened in the sun. It would look nice in the yard. Once he placed it, he'd place it once they were gone. Dad would be impressed that even after what had occurred, he'd remember to place the geode. "That's the ticket, Scout. We are well pleased, beloved only. Super job, Scout."
Holy crap. It was happening. She was marching along all meek like the trooper he'd known she'd be. He'd had her in mind since the baptism of what's-his-name, Sergei's kid, at the Russian church. She'd been standing in her yard, her dad or some such taking her picture. He'd been like, "Hello, Betty." Kenny had been like, "A little young, bro." He'd been like, "For you, Grandpa." When you studied history, the history of cultures, you saw your own individual time as hidebound. There were various theories of acquiescence. In Bible days, a king might ride through a field and go, "That one." And she would be brought unto him. And they would duly be betrothed. And if she gave birth unto a son, super, bring out the streamer. She was a keeper. Was she, that first night, digging it? Probably not. Was she shaking like a leaf? Didn't matter. What mattered was offspring and the furtherance of the lineage, plus the exaltation of the king, which resulted in righteous kingly power. Here was the creek. He marched her through. The following bullet points remained in the decision matrix. Take to side van door. Shove in. Follow in. Tape wrist mouth. Hook the chain. Make speech. He had the speech down cold. Had practiced it both in his head and on the tape recorder. "Calm your heart, darling. I know you're scared because you don't know me yet and didn't expect this today, but give me a chance and you will see we will fly high. See, I am putting a knife right over here and I don't expect I'll have to use it, right?" If she wouldn't get in the van, punch hard in gut. Then pick up, carry to side van door, throw in, tape wrist mouth, hook the chain, make speech, etc., etc. "Stop, pause," he said. Gal stopped. "Fuck's sake! Side door of the van was locked. How undisciplined was that?" Ensuring that the door was unlocked was clearly indicated on the pre-mission matrix. Melvin appeared in his mind. On Melvin's face was a look of hot disappointment that had always preceded an ass-whooping, which had always preceded the other thing. "Put up your hands," Melvin said. "Defend yourself." True, true, a little error there. Should have double-checked the pre-mission matrix. No biggie. Joy, not fear. Melvin was dead 15 years. Mom dead 12. "Our little bitch was turned around now, looking back at the house. That willfulness wouldn't stand. That was going to get nipped in the bud. He'd have to remember to hurt her early, establish a baseline." "Turn the fuck around," he said. She turned around. He unlocked the door, swung it open. Moment of truth. If she got in, let him use the tape, they were home free. He picked out a place in Sack, a big-ass cornfield, dirt road leading in. If fuckwise it went good, they'd pick up the freeway from there. Basically steal the van. It was Kenny's van. He borrowed it for the day. Screw Kenny. Kenny had once called him stupid. Too bad, Kenny. That remark just cost you one van. If fuckwise it went bad, she didn't properly arouse him, he'd abort the activity, truncate the subject, heave the thing out. Clean van is necessary. Go buy corn. Return van to Kenny. Say, "Hey, bro, here's a shitload of corn. Thanks for the van. I never could have bought a suitable quantity of corn in my car." Then lay low, watch the papers like he'd done with that non-arousing redhead out in... Gal gave him an imploring look, like, "Please don't." Was this a good time? To give her one in the gut, knock the wind out of her sails? It was. He did. The geode was beautiful. What a beautiful geode. What made it beautiful? What were the principal characteristics of a beautiful geode? Come on, think. Come on, concentrate.
She'll recover in time, beloved only.
None of our affair, Scout.
We're amazed by your good judgment, beloved only.
Dimly he noted that Allison had been punched. Eyes on the geode, he heard the little oof. His heart dropped at the thought of what he was letting happen. They'd used goldfish snacks as coins. They'd made bridges out of rocks, down by the creek, back in the day. Oh, God. He should have never stepped outside. Once they were gone, he'd just go back inside, pretend he'd never stepped out, make the model railroad town, still be making it when Mom and Dad got home. When eventually someone told him about it, he'd make a certain face. Already on his face, he could feel the face he would make, like, "What? Allison? Raped? Killed? Oh, God. Raped and killed while I innocently made my railroad town? Sitting cross-legged and unaware on the floor like a tiny little..." No. They'd be gone soon. Then he could go inside, call 911. Although, then everyone would know he'd done nothing. All his future life would be bad. Forever, he'd be the guy who'd done nothing. Besides, calling wouldn't do any good. They'd be long gone. The parkway was just across Featherstone with like a million arteries and clover leaves or whatever spouting out of it. So that was that. And he'd go, as soon as they left. Leave, he thought, so I can go inside, forget this ever. And then he was running across the lawn. Oh, God. What was he doing? Jesus. Shit. The directives he was violating. Running in the yard, bad for the sod. Transporting a geode without his protective wrapping. Hopping the fence, which stressed the fence, which had cost a pretty penny. Leaving the yard barefoot. Entering the secondary area without permission. Entering the creek barefoot, broken glass, dangerous microorganisms. And not only that, oh God, suddenly saw what this giddy part of himself intended, which is to violate a directive so major and absolute that it wasn't even a directive, since you didn't need a directive to know how totally verboten it was to... He burst out of the creek, the guy still not turning, and let the geode fly into his head, which seemed to emit a weird edge seep of blood even before the skull visibly indented and the guy sat right on his ass. Yes! Score! It was fun! Fun dominating a grown-up. Fun using the most dazzling gazelle-like leg speed ever seen in the history of mankind to dash soundlessly across space and master this huge galoot who otherwise, right now, would be... What if he hadn't? God, what if he hadn't? He imagined the guy bending Allison in two like a pale garment bag while pulling her hair and thrusting bluntly as he, Kyle, sat cowed and obedient, tiny railroad viaduct grasp in his pathetic, babyish... Jesus! He skipped over and hurled the geode through the windshield of the van, which imploded, producing an inward rain of glass shards that made the sound of thousands of tiny bamboo wind chimes. He scrambled up the hood of the van, retrieved the geode. Really? Really? You were going to ruin her life? Ruin my life, you cunt probe dick munch ass gashing animal? Who's bossing who now? Gash ass? Jizz lips? Turd munch? He'd never felt so strong, angry, wild. Who's the man? Who's your daddy? What else must he do to ensure that animal did no further harm? You still moving, freak? Got a plan, stroke dick? Want a skull gash on top of your existing skull gash, big man? You think I won't? You think I...
Easy, Scout. You're out of control.
Slow your motor down, beloved only.
Quiet. I'm the boss of me.
Fuck. What the hell? What was he doing on the ground? Had he tripped? Did someone wonk him? Did a branch fall? God damn.
He touched his head. His hand came away bloody. The beanpole kid was bending to pick something up, a rock.
Why was that kid off the porch? Where was the knife? Where was the gal?
Crab crawling toward the creek, flying across her yard,
going into her house. Fuck it, everything was fucked. Better hit the road.
With what, his good looks? He had like $8 total.
Ah, Christ, the kid had smashed the windshield with the rock. Kenny was not going to like that one bit.
He tried to stand but couldn't. The blood was just pouring out. He was not going to jail again. No way. He slit his wrists.
Where was the knife? He'd stab himself in the chest. That had nobility. Then the people would know his name. Which of them had the balls to samurai themselves with a knife in the chest? None. Nobody. Go ahead, pussy. Do it. No. The king does not take his own life. The superior man silently accepts the mindless rebuke of the rabble, waits to rise and fight anew. Plus, he had no idea where the knife was. Well, he didn't need it. He'd crawl into the woods, kill something with his bare hands. Or make a trap of some grass. Ugh, was he gonna barf? There he had, right on his lap.
Figures you'd blow the simplest thing, Melvin said.
Melvin, God, can't you see my head is bleeding so bad?
A kid did it to you. You're a joke. You got fucked by a kid.
Oh, sirens. Perfect. Well, it was a sad day for the cops. He'd fight them hand to hand. He'd sit until the last moment, watching them draw near, doing a silent death mantra that would centralize all his life power in his fists. He sat thinking about his fists. They were huge granite boulders. They were a pit bull each. He tried to get up. Somehow his legs weren't working. He hoped the cops would get here soon. His head really hurt. When he touched up there, things moved. It was like he was wearing a gore cap. He was gonna need a bunch of stitches. He hoped it wouldn't hurt too much. Probably it would, though. Where was that beanpole kid? Oh, here he was. Looming over him, blocking out the sun, rock held high, yelling something, but he couldn't tell what because of the ringing in his ears. Then he saw that the kid was gonna bring the rock down. He closed his eyes and waited and was not at peace at all, but instead felt the beginnings of a terrible dread welling up inside him. And if that dread kept growing at the current rate, he realized in a flash of insight, there was a name for the place he would be then, and it was hell.
Allison stood at the kitchen window. She'd peed herself, which was fine. People did that when super scared. She'd noticed it while making the call. Her hands had been shaking so bad. They still were. One leg was doing that thumper thing. God, the stuff he'd said to her. He'd punched her. He'd pinched her. There was a big blue mark on her arm. How could Kyle still be out there? But there he was in those comical shorts. So confident he was goofing around, hands clenched over his head like a boxer from some cute alt-universe where a kid that skinny could actually win a fight against a guy with a knife. Wait. His hands weren't clenched. He was holding the rock, shouting something down at the guy, who was on his knees like the blindfolded prisoner in that video they'd seen in history, about to get sword-killed by a formal dude in a helmet. Kyle, don't, she whispered. For months afterward, she had nightmares in which Kyle brought the rock down. She was on the deck trying to scream his name, but nothing was coming out. Down came the rock. Then the guy had no head. The blow just literally dissolved his head. Then his body tumped over, and Kyle turned to her with this heartbroken look of, my life is over. I killed a guy. Why was it, she sometimes wondered, that in dreams, we can't do the simplest things? Like, a crying puppy is standing on some broken glass, and you want to pick it up and brush the shards off its pads, but you can't because you're balancing a ball on your head? Or you're driving, and there's this old guy on crutches, and you go to Mr. Fader, your driver's ed teacher, should I swerve? And he's like, probably. But then you hear this big clunk, and Fader makes a negative mark in his book. Sometimes she'd wake up crying from the dream about Kyle. The last time, Mom and Dad were already there going, that's not how it was. Remember, Allie? How did it happen? Say it. Say it out loud. Allie, can you tell Mommy and Daddy how it really happened? I ran outside, she said. I shouted. That's right, Dad said. You shouted. Shouted like a champ. And what did Kyle do? Mom said. Put down the rock, she said. A bad thing happened to you kids, Dad said, but it could have been worse. So much worse, Mom said. But because of you kids, Dad said, it wasn't. You did so good, Mom said. Did beautiful, Dad said.
Sticks. Every year, Thanksgiving night, we flocked out behind Dad as he dragged the Santa suit to the road and draped it over a kind of crucifix he'd built out of metal pole in the yard. Super Bowl week, the pole was dressed in a jersey and Rod's helmet, and Rod had to clear it with Dad if he wanted to take the helmet off. On 4th of July, the pole was Uncle Sam. On Veterans Day, a soldier. On Halloween, a ghost. The pole was Dad's one concession to glee. We were allowed a single Crayola from the box at a time. One Christmas Eve, he shrieked at Kimmy for wasting an apple slice. He hovered over us as we poured ketchup, saying, good enough, good enough, good enough. Birthday parties consisted of cupcakes, no ice cream. The first time I brought a date over, she said, what's with your dad and that pole? And I sat there blinking. We left home, married, had children of our own, found the seeds of meanness blooming also within us. Dad began dressing the pole with more complexity and less discernible logic. He draped some kind of fur over it on Groundhog Day and lugged out a floodlight to ensure a shadow. When an earthquake struck Chile, he laid the pole on its side and spray-painted a rift in the earth. Mom died, and he dressed the pole as death and hung from the crossbar photos of Mom as a baby. We'd stop by and find odd talismans from his youth arranged around the base, army medals, theater tickets, old sweatshirts, tubes of Mom's makeup. One autumn, he painted the pole bright yellow. He covered it with cotton swabs that winter for warmth and provided offspring by hammering in 6 cross sticks around the yard. He ran lengths of string between the pole and the sticks and taped to the string letters of apology, admissions of error, pleas for understanding, all written in a frantic hand on index cards. He painted a sign saying love and hung it from the pole, and another that said forgive, and then he died in the hall with the radio on, and we sold the house to a young couple who yanked out the pole and left it by the road on garbage day. Puppy. Twice already, Marie had pointed out the brilliance of the autumnal sun on the perfect field of corn, because the brilliance of the autumnal sun on the perfect field of corn put her in mind of a haunted house. Not a haunted house she had actually ever seen, but the mythical one that sometimes appeared in her mind, with adjacent graveyard and cat on a fence, whenever she saw the brilliance of the autumnal sun on the perfect etc., etc. And she wanted to make sure that if the kids had a corresponding mythical haunted house that appeared in their minds whenever they saw the brilliance of the etc., etc., it would come up now, so that they could all experience it together, like friends, like college friends on a road trip. Sans pot, haha. But no, when she a third time said, "Wow, guys, check that out," Abby said, "Okay, Mom, we get it, it's corn." And Josh said, "Not now, Mom, I'm leavening my loaves." Which was fine with her, she had no problem with that. Noble Baker being preferable to Bra Stuffer, the game he'd asked for. Well, who could say? Maybe they didn't even have any mythical vignettes in their heads. Or maybe the mythical vignettes they had in their heads were totally different from the ones she had in her head. Which was the beauty of it, because after all, they were their own little people. You were just a caretaker. They didn't have to feel what you felt. They just had to be supported in feeling what they felt. Still, wow, that cornfield was such a classic. "Whenever I see a field like that, guys," she said, "I somehow think of a haunted house." "Slicing knife, slicing knife," Josh shouted. "You Nimrod machine, I chose that." Speaking of Halloween, she remembered last year when their cornstalk column had tipped their shopping cart over. Gosh, how they'd laughed at that. Oh, family laughter was golden. She'd had none of that in her childhood. Dad being so dour and Mom so ashamed. If Mom and Dad's card had tipped, Dad would have given the card a despairing kick and Mom would have stridden purposefully away to reapply her lipstick, distancing herself from Dad, while she, Marie, would have nervously taken that horrid plastic army man she'd named Brady into her mouth. Well, in this family, laughter was encouraged. Last night, when Josh had goosed her with his Game Boy, she'd shot a spray of toothpaste across the mirror and they'd all cracked up, rolling around on the floor with Gucci, and Josh had said such nostalgia in his voice, "Mom, remember when Gucci was a puppy?" Which was when Abby had burst into tears, because being only 5, she had no memory of Gucci as a puppy. Hence this family mission. And as far as Robert, oh, God bless Robert, there was a man. He would have no problem whatsoever with this family mission. She loved the way he had of saying, "Ho-ho," whenever she brought home something new and unexpected. "Ho-ho," Robert had said, coming home to find the iguana. "Ho-ho," he had said, coming home to find the ferret trying to get into the iguana cage. "We appear to be the happy operators of a menagerie." She loved him for his playfulness. You could bring home a hippo you'd put on a credit card. Both the ferret and the iguana had gone on credit cards. And he'd just say, "Ho-ho," and ask what the creature ate and what hours it slept and what the heck they were going to name the little bugger. In the back seat, Josh made the git, git, git sound he always made when his baker was in baking mode, trying to get his loaves into the oven while fighting off various hungry denizens, such as a fox with a distended stomach, such as a fey robin that would improbably carry the loaf away, speared on its beak, whenever it had succeeded in dropping a clonking rock on your baker, all of which Marie had learned over the summer by studying the Noble Baker manual while Josh was asleep. And it had helped, it really had, Josh was less withdrawn lately, and when she came up behind him now while he was playing and said, like, "Wow, honey, I didn't know you could do pumpernickel," or, "Sweetie, try serrated blade. It cuts quicker. Try it while doing latch the window," he would reach back with his non-controlling hand and swat at her affectionately. And yesterday they'd shared a good laugh when he'd accidentally knocked off her glasses. So her mother could go right ahead and claim that she was spoiling the kids. These were not spoiled kids. These were well-loved kids. At least she'd never left one of them standing in a blizzard for 2 hours after a junior high dance. At least she'd never drunkenly snapped at one of them, "I hardly consider you college material." At least she'd never locked one of them in a closet. A closet! While entertaining a literal ditch digger in the parlor. Oh God, what a beautiful world. The autumn colors, that glinting river, that lead-colored cloud pointing down like a rounded arrow at that half-remodeled McDonald's standing above I-90 like a castle. This time would be different, she was sure of it. The kids would care for this pet themselves, since a puppy wasn't scaly and didn't bite. "Ho ho," Robert had said the first time the iguana bit him. "I see you have an opinion on the matter." "Thank you, Lord," she thought, as Alexis flew through the cornfield. "You have given me so much. Struggles and the strength to overcome them. Grace and new chances every day to spread that grace around." And in her mind, she sang out, as she sometimes did when feeling that the world was good and she had at last found her place in it, "Ho, ho, ho, ho." Callie pulled back the blind. Yes, awesome. It was still solved so perfect. There was plenty for him to do back there. A yard could be a whole world, like her yard when she was a kid had been a whole world. From the three holes in their wood fence, she'd been able to see Exxon, hole one, and Accident Corner, hole two, and hole three was actually two holes that if you line them up right, your eyes would do this weird crossing thing and you could play "Oh My God, I Am So High" by staggering away with your eyes crossed going, "Peace, man, peace." When Bo got older, it would be different. Then he'd need his freedom, but now he just needed not to get killed. Once they'd found him way over on Testament, and that was across I-90. How would he cross I-90? She knew how. Darted. That's how he crossed streets. Once a total stranger had called him from Hightown Plaza. Even Dr. Bryle had said it. "Callie, this boy's going to end up dead if you don't get this under control. Is he taking the medications?" Well, he was and he wasn't. The meds made him grind his teeth and his fist would suddenly pound down. He broke in plates that way and once a glass tabletop and got 4 stitches in his wrist. Today, he didn't need the meds because he was safe in the yard because she'd fix it so perfect. He was out there practicing pitching by filling his Yankees helmet with pebbles and winging them at the tree. He looked up and saw her and did the thing where he blew a kiss. Sweet little man. Now all she had to worry about was the pup. She hoped a lady who'd called would actually show up. It was a nice pup. White with brown around one eye. Cute. If the lady showed up, she'd definitely want it. And if she took it, Jimmy was off the hook. He'd hated doing it that time with the kittens. But if no one took the pup, he'd do it. He'd have to. Because his feeling was, when you said you were going to do a thing and didn't do it, that was how kids got into drugs. Plus, he'd been raised on a farm, or near a farm anyways. And anybody raised on a farm knew you had to do what you had to do in terms of sick animals or extra animals, the pup being not sick, just extra. That time with the kittens, Brianna and Jesse had called him a murderer, getting Bo all worked up, and Jimmy had yelled, "Look, you kids, I was raised on a farm, and you gotta do what you gotta do." Then he'd cried in bed, saying how the kittens had mewed in the bag all the way to the pond, and how he wished he'd never been raised on a farm, and she'd almost said, "You mean near a farm?" His dad had run a car wash outside Cortland. But sometimes, when she got too smart-assed, he would do this hard pinching thing on her arm while waltzing her around the bedroom, as if the place where he was pinching was like her handle going, "I'm not sure I totally heard what you just said." So that time, after the kittens, she'd only said, "Oh, honey, you did what you had to do." And he'd said, "I guess I did, but it's sure not easy raising kids the right way." And then, because she hadn't made his life harder by being a smart-ass, they'd lain there making plans, like, why not sell this place and move to Arizona and buy a car wash? Why not buy the kids hooked on phonics? Why not plant tomatoes? And then they got to wrestling around, and she had no idea why she remembered this. He'd done this thing of, while holding her close, bursting this sudden laugh, despair snort into her hair like a sneeze or like he was about to start crying. Which had made her feel special, him trusting her with that. So what she'd love for tonight was getting the pup sold, putting the kids to bed early, and then Jimmy seeing her as all organized in terms of the pup, they could mess around and afterward lie there making plans, and he could do that laugh snort thing in her hair again. Why that laugh snort meant so much to her, she had no freaking idea. It was just one of the weird things about the wonder that was her, ha ha ha. Outside, Bo hopped to his feet, suddenly curious, because here we go, the lady who'd called had just pulled up. Yep, and in a nice car too, which meant too bad she'd put cheap in the ad. Abby squealed, "I love it, Mommy, I want it," as the puppy looked up dimly from its shoebox, and the lady of the house went trudging away, and 1, 2, 3, 4 plucked up 4 dog turds from the rug. Well, wow, what a super field trip for the kids, Marie thought. Ha ha. The filth, the mildew smell, the dry aquarium holding the single encyclopedia volume, the pasta pot on the bookshelf with an inflatable candy cane inexplicably sticking out of it, and although some might have been disgusted by the spare tire on the dining room table, by the way the glum mother dog, the presumed in-house pooper, was now dragging her rear over the pile of clothing in the corner in a sitting position, splay-legged, moronic look of pleasure on her face, Marie realized, resisting the urge to rush to the sink and wash her hands, in part because the sink had a basketball in it, that what this really was deeply sad. "Please do not touch anything. Please do not touch," she said to Josh and Abby, but just in her head, wanting to give the children a chance to observe her being democratic and accepting, and afterward they could all wash up at the half-remodeled McDonald's, as long as they just please, please kept their hands out of their mouths, and God forbid they should rub their eyes. The phone rang, and the lady of the house plodded into the kitchen, placing the daintily held paper towel-wrapped turds on the counter. "Mommy, I want it," Abby said. "I will definitely walk them like twice a day," Josh said.
"Don't say like," Marie said.
"I'll definitely walk him twice a day," Josh said.
Okay then, all right, they would adopt a white trash dog. Ha ha, they could name it Zeke. Bite a little corncob pipe and a straw hat. She imagined the puppy, having crapped on the rug, looking up at her going, "Can't help it." But no, had she come from a perfect place, everything was transmutable. She imagined the puppy grown up, entertaining some friends, speaking to them in a British accent. "My family of origin was, rather not, shall we say, of the most respectable..."
Ha ha, wow, the mind was amazing, always cranking out these... Marie stepped to the window and, anthropologically pulling the blind aside, was shocked. So shocked that she dropped the blind and shook her head, as if trying to wake herself. Shocked to see a young boy, just a few years younger than Josh, harnessed and chained to a tree via some sort of doohickey by which... She pulled the blind back again, sure she could not have seen what she thought she had. When the boy ran, the chain spooled out. He was running now, looking back at her, showing off. When he reached the end of the chain, it jerked and he dropped as if shot. He rose to a sitting position, railed against the chain, whipped it back and forth, crawled to a bowl of water, and lifting it to his lips, took a drink from a dog's bowl. Josh joined her at the window. She let him look. He should know that the world was not all lessons and iguanas and Nintendo. It was also this muddy, simple boy, tethered like an animal. She remembered coming out of the closet to find her mother's scattered lingerie and the ditch digger's metal hanger full of orange flags. She remembered waiting outside the junior high in the bitter cold, the snow falling harder as she counted over and over to 200. Promising herself each time that when she reached 200, she would begin the long walk back. God, she would have killed for just one righteous adult to confront her mother, shake her, say, "You idiot, this is your child. Your child, your..." "So what were you guys thinking of naming him?" the woman said, coming out of the kitchen. The cruelty and ignorance just radiated from her fat face with its little smear of lipstick. "I'm afraid we won't be taking him after all," Marie said coldly. Such an uproar from Abby. But Josh, she would have to praise him later, maybe buy him the Italian Loaves expansion pack, hiss something to Abby, and then they were moving out through the trashed kitchen, past some kind of crankshaft on a cookie sheet, past a partial red pepper afloat in a can of green paint, while the lady of the house scuttled after them saying, "Wait, wait, they could have it free, please take it." She just really wanted them to have it. No, Marie said, it would not be possible for them to take it at this time, her feeling being that one really shouldn't possess something if one wasn't up to properly caring for it.
Oh,
the woman said, slumping in the doorway, the scrambling pup on one shoulder. Out in the Lexus, Abby began to cry softly, saying, "Really, that was the perfect pup for me." And it was a nice pup, but Marie was not going to contribute to a situation like this in even the smallest way. Simply was not going to do it. The boy came to the fence. If only she could say to him with a single look, "Life will not necessarily always be like this. Your life could suddenly blossom into something wonderful. It can happen. It happened to me." But secret looks, looks that conveyed a world of meaning with their subtle blah, 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 that was all bullshit. What was not bullshit was a call to child welfare, where she knew Linda Burling, a very no-nonsense lady who would snatch this poor kid away so fast it would make that fat mother's stick head spin. Callie shouted, "Bo, back in a sec," and swiping the corn out of the way with her non-pup arm, walked until there was nothing but corn and sky. It was so small it didn't move when she set it down, just sniffed and thumped over. Well, what did it matter, drowned in a bag or starved in the corn? This way Jimmy wouldn't have to do it. He had enough to worry about. The boy she'd first met with hair to his waist was now this old man shrunk with worry. As far as the money, she had 60 hidden away. She'd give him 20 of that and go, "The people who bought the pup were super nice." "Don't look back, don't look back," she said in her head as she raced away through the corn. Then she was walking along Tealback Road like a sport walker, like some lady who walked every night to get slim. Except that she was nowhere near slim, she knew that, and also knew that when sport walking you did not wear jeans and unlaced hiking boots. Aha. She wasn't stupid. She just made bad choices. She remembered Sister Lynette saying, "Callie, you are bright enough, but you incline toward that which does not benefit you." "Yep, well, sister, you got that right," she said to the nun in her mind. But what the hell? What the heck? When things got easier money-wise, she'd get some decent tennis shoes and start walking and get slim. And start night school. Slimmer. Maybe medical technology. She was never going to be really slim. But Jimmy liked her the way she was, and she liked him the way he was. Which maybe that's what love was, liking someone how he was and doing things to help him get even better. Like right now, she was helping Jimmy by making his life easier, by killing something so he... No. All she was doing was walking. Walking away from... What did she just said? That had been good. Love was liking someone how he was and doing things to help him get even better. Like, Bo wasn't perfect, but she loved him how he was and tried to help him get better. If they could keep him safe, maybe he'd mellow out as he got older. If he mellowed out, maybe he could someday have a family. Like there he was now, in the yard, sitting quietly looking at flowers, tapping with his bat, happy enough. He looked up, waved the bat at her, gave her that smile. Yesterday he'd been stuck in the house all miserable. He'd ended the day screaming in bed, so frustrated. Today, he was looking at flowers. Who was it that thought up that idea, the idea that had made today better than yesterday? Who loved him enough to think that up? Who loved him more than anyone else in the world loved him? Her. She did. Escape from Spiderhead. 1. "Drip on?" Abnesti said over the PA. "What's in it?" I said. "Hilarious," he said. "Acknowledge," I said. Abnesti used his remote. My MobiPack word. Soon the interior garden looked really nice. Everything seemed super clear. I said out loud, as I was supposed to, what I was feeling. "Garden looks nice," I said. "Super clear." Abnesti said, "Jeff, how about we pep up those language centers?" "Sure," I said. "Drip on," he said. "Acknowledge," I said. He added some verbaloose to the drip. And soon I was feeling the same things, but saying them better. The garden still looked nice. It was like the bushes were so tight-seeming and the sun made everything stand out. It was like any moment you expected some Victorians to wander in with their cups of tea. It was as if the garden had become a sort of embodiment of the domestic dreams forever intrinsic to human consciousness. It was as if I could suddenly discern, in this contemporary vignette, the ancient corollary through which Plato and some of his contemporaries might have strolled. To wit, I was sensing the eternal in the ephemeral. I sat, pleasantly engaged in these thoughts, until the verbaloose began to wane, at which point the garden just looked nice again. It was something about the bushes and whatnot. It made you just want to lay out there and catch rays and think your happy thoughts, if you get what I mean. Then, whatever else was in the drip wore off, and I didn't feel much about the garden one way or the other. My mouth was dry, though, and my gut had that post-verbaloose feel to it. "What's going to be cool about that one," Abnesti said, "is say a guy has to stay up late guarding a perimeter, or is at school waiting for his kid and gets bored, but there's some nature nearby. Or say a park ranger has to work a double shift." "That will be cool," I said. "That's ED-763, he said. "We're thinking of calling it Natuglide, or maybe Earth Admire." "Those are both good," I said. "Thanks for your help, Jeff," he said, which is what he always said. "Only a million years to go," I said, which is what I always said. Then he said, "Exit the interior garden now, Jeff. Head over to small workroom 2. 2. Into small workroom 2, they sent this pale, tall girl. "What do you think?" Abnesti said over the PA. "Me," I said, "or her?" "Both," Abnesti said. "Pretty good," I said. "Fine, you know," she said, "normal." Abnesti asked us to rate each other more quantifiably, as per pretty, as per sexy. It appeared we liked each other about average, i.e. no big attraction or revulsion either way. Abnesti said, "Jeff, drip on." "Acknowledge," I said. "Heather, drip on," he said. "Acknowledge," Heather said. Then we looked at each other like, what happens next? What happened next was Heather soon looked super good. And I could tell she thought the same of me. It came on so sudden we were like laughing. How could we not have seen it? How cute the other one was.